Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. In the interest of time, please continue eating. We're going to start the program. It's about 1:15. I'm Robert Greaves. I'm a member of the professional committee of the FCC, and I'm going to be moderating today with our guest. Before we start, please turn off your electronic devices, and we'll get going. I'm really happy to have as a guest, our guest today, Ken Koyanagi, who is the publisher of Nikkei Asian Review. He's also a staff writer for Nikkei, a weekly publication, daily publication. He's been a 26-year veteran journalist all over the world. He's got great experience since the summer of 2012. He's been involved in the development of this publication. And I think the title says it all, Why Asia Needs New International Media, and I'm pretty interested in this as well. So without further ado, I am going to introduce, ask Ken to come up here. And since we're a small group, I'd like this to be very interactive. So once he's done with his remarks, please ask a lot of questions. So let's welcome Ken Koyanagi.
Which one? Okay. Thank you, Robert, for a nice introduction. Since it's going to be a tough press conference here, I will roll up my sleeves and start talking. Please forgive me for my poor English, because I'm a pure Japanese. I grew up in Japan until I was 22. So I tried to be really fluent, but might not be. So, okay. I prepared some slides for you. It's messy desktop I have. Okay. All right.
You recognize the background.
All right. Okay. Alrighty. So I'd like to talk about the media industry landscape today, and its relation to Nikkei Inc.'s decision to start this new publication called Nikkei Asian Review. First, you know, a lot of things are happening still in the media industry, which has been a struggling industry for the past 15, 20 years, actually, but there are still lots going on. And for example, these two gentlemen, I think everybody knows who they are, and they are very interested in buying out this very well-known British publication. It's a daily pink paper. And there has been a continuous rumor that Pearson, which is a parent company of this daily paper, has been put this publication on sale in the market, and there are a lot of investment bankers and private equity funds moving around the world, and actually they are proposing deals to these gentlemen. And actually, Michael Bloomberg have been set to be in London this March, April timeframe, and talked about the possible deal, but it apparently failed. And Financial Times is said to be doing good, relatively better than other daily newspapers in the developed world. But in reality, from my internal sources, they are struggling as well. They're barely making money, and that's. That symbolizes the situation right now we are in the newspaper industry. And the reason, there have been disruptors, mainly from the West Coast USA. And, you know, Google destroyed the traditional advertisement market, and Jeff Bezos destroyed the value of paper. And of course, late Steve Jobs, who presented, started supplying alternative to portable medium like paper. So these disruptors completely changed the landscape of the traditional media industry. And actually, I used to be a Silicon Valley bureau chief in early 2000 and interviewed all of these guys. And I mainly wrote about how you know, traditional media industry is lagging behind the innovations going on in the world and criticized, actually, my company, which has been always laggard, lagging behind these innovations. And what happened because of those disruptors? Western traditional media kept cutting newsroom workforce. This is the graph of U.S. newspaper newsroom workforce, and it declined dramatically. And what they did was mainly cutting all those foreign correspondents posted in Asian nations and European nations, and especially Japan, because Japan is said to be said to have had lost 20 years, lost two decades, starting in 1990. A lot of U.S. and Western media closed their bureaus in Tokyo, and they just concentrated reporters into China. And some of them cut bureaus in Southeast Asia as well. And so Western media are no longer a strong existence in Asia. That's what we felt. And not only Western media that have been hurt by those disruptions. There are those, of course, everybody remembers these publications, I think. And Asia Week closed in 2001, and Far Eastern Economic Review closed in 2009. And Asia Week was owned by Time Warner, and Far Eastern Economic Review, FEAR, was owned by Dow Jones, but they decided to discontinue these publications. So until recently, when we started publication, a new publication called Nikkei Asian Review, there was no pan-Asian media, no pan-Asian global media, I would say. And this is a rumor. Probably Dow Jones bought FEAR because they wanted to establish their Asian Wall Street Journal as a only competitive English language international media in Asia, and to kill FEAR. And this is a kind of a talk by a senior editor at FEAR that Dow Jones basically changed the FEAR's contents after they bought FEAR and into something like airline magazines. And so, of course, this is a kind of conspiracy theory, but I believe this person, this former senior editor, strongly suspects that DJ bought FEAR to kill it. And Japan, I don't know if you know or not, but Japanese daily papers have been really relatively strong compared to US and European daily papers because there are big national dailies, four big national dailies actually in Japan. And the biggest one is Yomiuri. It claims to have a daily circulation of 10 million. And Asahi claims to have 8 million. And Mainichi claims to have 5 million. And Nikkei has 2.8. And Sankei claims to have 2 million. And they're keeping it, actually. Their decline is not really serious compared to US papers because they have a strong nationwide home delivery networks. They own those networks, and they hire young, mainly high school and college students to deliver those morning papers to every house, every household. So it's like a Coca-Cola business model. Once you have established a strong distribution network, it's very difficult to destroy that business. But all the more, a lot of local papers are going down. So this is a trend, recent trend of circulation and advertisement revenue in Japanese newspaper industry. The red dots are circulation, and blue dots are advertisement revenue. It went down dramatically. It is said annually there is one local paper going down in Japan. So in other words, there is a strong opposition by national papers in Japan. And it is a crisis of diversity of news reporting in Japan. And Nikkei is no exception. This is a comparison between 2005 and 2013. Nikkei's consolidated revenues, it went down. It went down. And actually, our advertisement revenue right now is one-third of the peak we used to have in early 2000. So we are having very, very hard time. And our circulation is down in on downward pressure as well. And the revenue decline, despite we have been relatively successful in establishing online edition, which now has 350,000 paid subscribers. And we believe it is the fourth largest daily papers online services after New York Times and Wall Street Journal and Financial Times. And we are charging basically 4,000 yen, which is about $40 per month to subscribers, and which is a very, very high price. And when we started this business, people called us insane. But somehow people followed us and supported us, our services. And so now it has reached 350,000 paid subscribers. And it's growing steadily. But our total revenue is going down because of the downward pressure on circulation and, of course, advertisement shrinkage. And the management felt a very, very strong crisis feeling about this shrinkage and the declining revenues. And look at our own business portfolio. And these are newspapers. We have four newspapers, and we have publishing division, which has lots of magazines, and also publish books. And we also have a broadcasting business with a terrestrial network and satellite channel and radio station. And also we have a data feeding business called Quick to financial institutions. It is something like Bloomberg and Reuters. But they are all domestic. That's what they found out, our management. And they started looking at our neighbors. This is advertising market growth in Asian nations. They're growing. China, close to 9. India, close to 8. Indonesia, more than 10. Philippines, 15. So these Southeastern nations, their advertising markets is still very young and growing. And our management saw an business opportunity here, naturally. And again, there has been a vacancy in the Asian media, international media market. And they then started looking at ourselves. What do we have? We have over 20 bureaus in Asian region. And we have lots of bureaus, of course, in Japan. And we have 1,300 journalists in our editorial bureau. So maybe we might be capable of doing something about the Asian media industry. So the board made the decision last June, to integrate all the English language publications we used to have into one brand, which is the Nikkei Asian Review. And also they decided to invest tens of millions of dollars for coming, say, 5 to 7 years, mainly for business development and system development, and also for promotion. And our target is 100,000 paid subscribers by 2018. And this is something we came up with as a new English publication. It is a multi-platform business magazine, with website and print, and also mobile application for tablets and smartphones. And we call the entire thing a publication called Nikkei Asian Review. Actually, we modeled after The Economist. It's a weekly magazine with a website and application. So The Economist is something like a teacher for us. Our target audience, we target both Westerners and Asians. Westerners, those who are working with Asia and working in Asia, and those who are watching Asia. And Asians, cross-border workers, and those who like to see their own organizations, their own companies and government branches covered by global media. And of course, those Asians living in the West. And they have something in common, which is English speaking, and they're intellectual, highly educated, and leaders, and they tend to have high income. And what do we cover? Asia is a very vague word, so we defined it as somewhere between Turkey and New Zealand, which is very broad. And our content genres are politics, economy, and business. And we will start covering regularly 300 particular major companies in Asia. And we will call it A300. And we will start bolstering this idea in coming fall. And of course, we cover markets, but we don't cover a minutes-by-minutes market movements, but we cover the why markets move in a particular direction or not. And technology and science, of course. And we have lots of contributed articles from external writers and experts. And also, we value arts and culture and lifestyle because it tells each local region's characteristic and value. And also, we put some energy on photos as well. And this is a very difficult part. We declare that we have Asian perspectives, and we write those perspectives for global readers. It is easy to say, but difficult to execute. So it's a try and error process we are going through. But we try to establish Asian perspective, which is not Japanese, which is not Chinese, which is not Vietnamese, but it is Asian. It is difficult, but we will try. And also, as a competitiveness, we try to have both breadth and depth of coverage. For example, those 300 companies, you know, no other Western media would cover daily, but we will try covering those individual companies. That's a breadth. And also, we try to add some analytical and in-depth analysis and feature factor to those stories. And the third thing is very important. We don't become treacherous with the Western democracy, because there are a lot of variation in political styles in Asian nations. And we cannot be judgmental about those political systems in Asian nations, because the reality is there are very few pure Western democracies in Asia. But since we declare that we are the media of Asian people, we have to be really objective to those political systems. So we value economics and science as a measure of judgment or value measurement, and not political ideology. And also, to sell our product, we claim to be very, very independent. Actually, Nikkei is owned by employee shareholding entity. And also, we bolster pluralism, which is close to, you know, there are something I said about economics and science, because there are a lot of various cultures and religions and ethnic groups in Asia, so we have to be really pluralistic. But at the ground, we have to value basic human rights. If someone is kidnapped, we criticize it. If someone is being tortured, we criticize it. And also, something we are trying to be is we want to become the forum about Asia, gathering all the insights from experts around the world who have insights on Asia. This is a subscription plan. If you If you are interested, please subscribe to it. It's if it's digital only, it's $18 a month. And if you want a print version as well, it's $28 a month. And also, we have a native app for iPhone and Android. And also, we have a corporate contracts as well. Well, this is something I would skip. And this is very important. There are very few media organizations who are newly hiring in this world. And this is something really new. Actually, I was struck to hear that Washington Post has hired 50 staffers this year already, after Jeff Bezos bought the newspaper. And meanwhile, we are hiring everywhere in Asia. Actually, we have hired already three ex-FT editors who are present here, actually, who have been really, really working hard. And also, we have been hiring local reporters in Taipei, Manila, Bangkok, Kuala Lumpur, and Jakarta. And also, we are trying to find a new local reporter in Vietnam and India, and also an editor in Tokyo. And also, we expanded our Bangkok bureau into a regional hub newsroom. We call it Nikkei headquarters, editorial headquarters for Asia, with some Japanese editors and local editors as well. And this is about it. So why do we need the new regional publication, news publication in Asia? Because we had a very terrible experience after the earthquake. There are suddenly many, many Western reporters coming into Tokyo and other areas in Japan after the earthquake and tsunami. And they made a very terrible reports, actually. They made a lot of mistakes. For example, they reported there is a nuclear power plant in the heart of Tokyo. And actually, there is a dance club, I mean, live band club, very in the center of the Tokyo called Eggman. And which has a door with a yellow and black sign of a nuke. And the reporters, Fox, thought it was a nuclear power plant. And they put it into their all the chart. They ran it on their TV shows and website, which is totally untrue. And we were shocked how careless those Western media are about Japan. And because of the vacancy in the Pan-Asian medium, we strongly felt that this is probably our job to cover ourselves as an Asia. That's the main reason we decided to start this publication. In addition to those business reasons where we wanted a new source of growth in our business. So this is why we think we have a very good reason to start this publication. Okay, I think I spent 20 minutes, and probably it's better to open up for questions.
Great, thank you very much, Ken. Appreciate that. Are there any questions right now? Yes, sir.
Hello, I'm George Russell. I'm a sort of journalist in this town. You mentioned that there is a vacancy for a Pan-Asian publication. When we look at recent history, Asia Week, Paris Syndicate Review, other attempts by Nikkei, English version of Asahi Shimbun, maybe there isn't a vacancy for a Pan-Asian publication. I'm wondering if Nikkei has considered that. Secondly, whether journalists in Japan, and obviously there'd be exceptions, do have a reputation for timidity in the face of authority, especially corporate authority. Whether they're beholden to corporate interests or whether it's only a domestic thing, there are obviously some terrific Japanese foreign correspondents. Is this a chance that it could hold back some of the reporting?
Good questions. The first, yes, there is a risk that the fact is, the reality is there is no vacancy in this market, and we have talked about it a lot. And to be honest, we don't know. So we just decided to give it a try, and we know it is a very difficult business, and as I said, our target is very broad, so it's not really convincing to advertisers as well. But We claim to be a magazine for cosmopolitans, so that's one way to go. But anyway, I think after 5 years, we will know whether or not there has been a vacancy in the media market. And regarding the second question, actually Nikkei is kind of notorious for, you know, being soft on corporate leaders, because we are newspapers for those corporations, actually. But we are not intimidating. We are trying to be polite, and we try to respect business leaders. But if there's something wrong, we don't hesitate to write about it. And that's another reputation we have, actually, in Japan. Maybe nobody outside Japan knows that Nikkei is a newspaper company. Many people think it's a stock index company like Dow Jones, but we have 140 years of tradition of journalism covering business and economy. So in that, in terms of the quality of our analysis, especially in economic and business terms, we are quite confident. What we are not confident about is the ability of the English language, actually. since we are hiring a lot of English-speaking journalists, I think we can catch up. That's my answer.
Thanks very much. That's a very good question. I went through two issues last night, recent issues of Nikkei, and it's the same viewpoint, universalist international viewpoint as the others. I was actually expecting to see more of a Japanese viewpoint in there, and I didn't, so it's going to be interesting. My follow-up question to that is, what has been the reception so far of the publication?
You mean outside Japan?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Maybe it's because I am the publisher of the magazine. I keep hearing good words. People compliment this magazine, new venture magazine, I would say, and a lot of people have told me this is something they have been waiting for. So it is only 6 months old publication. So far, I have a very good feeling. We have a monthly page view of 3 million, which is not bad for a newborn publication. And we are printing 10,000 copies weekly and spreading all around the world. So. Although we are not charging money a lot, but I think we have had a good start.
Right. Any more questions? Yes, Bettina.
On the print product, I was wondering if in the days of when paper is dying, paper is going away, did you internally consider keeping the print product off the table, as it were, and just to go online? Only was that something that you considered internally, and maybe a follow up question on the performance so far. How much of a time frame do you give yourself till you reach break even? You got an investment, and how long do you think that'll last you? Thanks.
Okay, the second question first. We set the 5 years as a limit to reach break even point, so it's going to be 2008 with 100,000 copies. 100,000 paid subscribers. And the first question, of course, we had a very, very long and a very active discussions about whether or not we should do print. We reached the conclusion that if we don't have a print edition, we wouldn't exist in this world. And especially if imagine if we didn't have a print edition, I wouldn't have been here, actually. I wouldn't have been invited here because nobody has seen it. So we decided, for the promotion reason, we should have print editions. And also, when we ask some experts to write a piece for us, and if we send a copy of the print edition to them after they wrote piece, they would really appreciate it, and they think this is a real publication. For those reasons, we decided to do print. And actually, it doesn't make money at all. It is a cost. But we regard the cost of doing print business as a promotion cost. That's a strategy.
Yes. Well, before, would you please state your name and organization? I've been falling down in that regard. Yes, go ahead.
Sarah Monks. I'm a member of the club. Would you be able to share a little bit more about your internal discussions on what is an Asian perspective? You alluded to the fact that this is quite a complex issue. I couldn't agree with you more. But when you look around the region and you see different Asian perspectives on maps and who owns what, and that, of course, does spill into the business world, as we're now seeing in Vietnam with the torching of factories, could you also consider the presence of many Asian thought leaders who were educated in Western universities, Harvard, Yale in particular, and Oxford and Cambridge, and of course many Westerners who've come and embedded themselves in Asia and speak Japanese or Mandarin? I so admire those who do, and might claim to have an Asian perspective. So I'd love to hear a bit more about this debate over what is an Asian perspective.
Okay. Actually, there is no simple answer to that. It's a try and error process. Of course, we are Japanese companies, so we cannot avoid being a Japanese whenever we write about things happening in Asia. For example, to be very honest, so Chinese boats attacked Vietnamese boat. Most of the Japanese feel that Chinese are really arrogant and violent and rogue, I would say. But there is some way to write about it, not being so explicitly hostile to Chinese. There should be a way to write about it in a really objective way, but at the same time, in a very local way. So from a standpoint of someone who lives inside that area, but who doesn't take really a stance, we have to seek that kind of narrow path between being nationalistic and being local and being global. And something we have decided was, so we say to ourselves, let's try to be cross-border. So whenever we write about something happening in a certain country, we don't finish it within a country context, but we put some other neighboring countries' context as well. And that would make really that story a regional rather than a local. And that's something we're trying to pursue. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, yes. Christian, did you have a question?
Christian Schubert, I work for BASF, the chemical company. I actually had the same question because I was surprised that if you talk about an Asian perspective, your exclusive interview is with the CEO of Morgan Stanley. I would have thought that then you're also featuring leaders from this region, bringing CEOs who give an Asian perspective with the question mark, what that is.
Yes. We are trying to do a lot of interviews with local leaders, business leaders, political leaders. Of course, Japanese leaders as well, and we have had already exclusive interview with Shinzo Abe, which is who is the Prime Minister of Japan, and also some political leaders in Asian countries as well. And since we start covering all those specific individual companies in Asia, probably we will have a lot of more interviews with those Asian leaders as well. But at the same time, we are very interested in those American business people, you know, thinking about Asia. And that's going to influence the living and policies and strategies of Asian governments and business organizations and individuals as well. So those Western view on Asia are also very important contents for us.
More questions? Yes, sir.
My name is Vishwanathan. I'm a member of the club.
Okay.
I'm quite impressed with your courage to start this publication. You have come to fill a vacancy, but the vacancy came to exist only very recently because, as you said, Forest and Economic Review was bought out by Asian Journal. Similarly, Time Magazine also decided to close down Asia Week because of its success, not because it did not make money. In that context, what makes you think that you can succeed and others will not buy you out?
Because we are a private company. There's no way they can buy
it. Sober there.
What's that?
Sober Review and Asia Week also were private companies.
Well, there was one family or one group of people who owned the company, right? But Nikkei is owned by employees. So it is very hard to buy out Nikkei. But there's some way probably, you know, because we have some public stock listed companies as our affiliates, like TV Tokyo, which is whose stocks are listed in Tokyo Stock Exchange. Probably they can buy those shares in the market, but not Nikkei Inc. itself. Well, but I hope we could become as successful as something that could be a target of those buyouts.
Another question. I have one. Would you ever write about changing Japan's constitution or some of the more sensitive issues in Japan?
I think it's more of a matter of opinion rather than news reporting. So, for example, if we have a public poll asking whether, you know, Japanese national support the constitutional reform or not, we would report that objectively. But we don't do, as an editorial, we don't do a story about it. Probably we would invite some experts, probably foreign policy expert for once, and Japanese experts for a second. We would run contributed pieces on a magazine. That would make me feel more comfortable.
Just as a follow-up, how do you choose your columnists and the people that do the opinion pieces for you?
Well, I trust my editors. If they find the right person in the right time, I would let them commission those contributing pieces.
Seems very broad.
Yes.
Any other questions? Anything else? Yes. I'm sorry. Enid.
Declaration of interest. I do have a job at the Nikkei Asian Review, but I'm on the editorial side, so obviously I don't know what's going on the commercial side. So maybe you could share with us how Nikkei plans to sell this publication and to promote it, because at the moment it's sort of still in a sort of soft launch period, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Actually, mainly, I'm trying to make this publication known to influencers like yourselves. And I try to be a speaker of these events in various cities. That's something we are doing right now. But starting from fall, we would start a major advertisement campaign, probably outside the airport, on the road. Probably we would do tram wrapping in Hong Kong, for example. And sometimes probably we would sponsor a certain particular TV program, for example, on, say, Channel News Asia or somewhere. So I think our promotion campaign will be far more visible after, say, October. And we're going to invest millions of dollars into those promotional activities. That's our plan.
Would you consider publishing in an Asian language, a language other than English?
Good question. I don't think so. Because our target is very, as I said, it's a cosmopolitan. So if a certain audience is Asian, he must be or she must be a very cross-border executive or elite business people. And those who must be able to read and speak English. And if we start publishing this publication in local languages, it becomes rather a popular or more secular publication. We try to keep it as a primary publication, so strategically we keep it only in the English language for the time being. But after 5 years, I don't know. We may decide start maybe Thai language or Indonesian language versions as well. But so far, we have no plan to do that.
Is 5 years your horizon, your cutoff?
Yeah.
Okay.
I could be fired in 5 years.
we have time for some more. I'm going to ask, Bettina, okay, again.
Actually, I'll pass the mic on because my question was sort of along the line of the commercial side as well.
Annette Johnson, I'm also a member of the club here. I just wanted to, you showed a chart of your subscriber fees there, but is the intention to be a subscriber-driven model, or are you looking more at an advertising-driven model, and how do you sort of envisage your revenues coming from those two different pools of...
Yeah, for the first 1-2 years, it has to be a subscription-driven model because the circulation and traffic, web traffic, are too small to make advertisement a sizable business. But after a couple of years, when we have a sufficient size of web traffic and circulation, probably we would shift towards advertisement more. That's my image of a coming couple of years. Does that answer your question? Is it? Oh, I see. Well, you know, pricing is a very difficult question, actually. And we have lots of discussions about pricing. But this is, you know, we decided this price point, like $18 a month, looking at prices of other publications like FT, FT.com, and The Economist. And we thought maybe it shouldn't be higher than The Economist because The Economist is such an elite publication. So we set this price just under The Economist. And you know, to be very honest, it is very difficult to tell whether or not this pricing is right or not. So I think we will keep trial and errors about pricing as well.
Sarah?
It's me again. Could you give us some idea of why you chose Bangkok for your editorial headquarters in Asia?
Good question.
That's a good question.
Actually, that was not my decision. you know, we set up a regional business headquarters in Singapore, actually, in April. And we talked about placing editorial headquarters in Singapore as well. But as you know, there is a very, very strong regulation about editorial side in Singapore. So we decided to put our editorial centers in somewhere else. And that was a choice between Hong Kong and Bangkok. And after that, that was our president's choice. And simply, president liked Bangkok better than Hong Kong, probably. I don't know. That kind of personal decision that was. So, sorry, it's not a really logical answer, but that was a reality.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Lee Hawley. I have my own human resources consulting business. I'm a member of the club as well. I was wondering, had you considered also a G300 perspective on business beyond your A300?
You mean global?
Yeah, global 300 in operating in Asia. So, for example, the GlaxoSmithKline news story that's getting a lot of attention right now would be of interest, I think.
Actually, we never thought about naming those group of companies as G300, but... yeah, thank you for a nice idea. I would propose to my editorial team to regularly cover those global companies operating in Asia. That's a very good story as well, yeah.
Any more? One more? No? Well, in that case, I would like to thank Ken Koyanagi for being here. He's obviously a very bright Ken. If this doesn't work out, Graydon Carter's leaving Vanity Fair in the next year. You might be able to pick up the editorship of that. But seriously, this is great. It's very seldom that we get a new magazine starting up anywhere, but particularly one in Asia. It's quite exciting. We wish you all good luck, and thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
On behalf of the club,
you very much.
Thank you. I'm honored.
It's a little something, parting gift.
So okay. All right.
Before I let you go, I just want to say a couple of more things. We are going to have on the 19th Lita Hong Fincher talking about leftover women, the resurgence of gender inequality in China. And on the 23rd of May, Gilbert Gostein, Sumei Thompson, Denise Chang, Tara Joseph, and Christy Lou Stout will be talking about presenting the Women's Empowerment Journalism Awards. Thank you all very much for coming today.